Now, I asked him, because we've been talking about dispensations. We've walked through the seven dispensations that we recognize in the Word of God. If a person doesn't agree with all seven of those, we're not going to fight. There are three key ones that a believer should recognize, that there's the law, that's the key one, grace, a key one which you live under, and then the fullness of times. Those are the three key ones that a believer ought to recognize. There are others in there, and I think those are also helpful, and they make a lot of sense. But from that, talking about dispensations, now we're going to be moving out into talking about eternity. Eternity. Now, I asked Clayton if he heard that. Hannah, how old was she? One. How old was she, Joanna? One. Okay. How old was she, Clayton?
One.
One. Okay. Clinton was going, you're asking me? She's one. What does that mean when we say that somebody has turned one? How long have they lived?
1 year.
They've lived 1 year. How old are you, Joanna? You're six. Now, you've lived more than 6 years because you've had a few months. But when you say six, it means you've been living where your mom and dad can see you, and your brothers and your sisters and the other people that are your friends and people at church, they can see you, that you've been around for 6 years. How old are you, Clayton?
Seven.
Seven? So that means how many years have you been alive?
Seven.
7 years. Technically, they've been alive longer than that, right? Not just because of the number of years, but they've been alive even before they were born, they were alive. But you get the idea. 7 years, 6 years. So we're talking about time. We're talking about time that goes by. How do we know what time it is? We look at our watches. Or if you're the new generation, you don't wear watches anymore, you look at your phone. Yeah. It's amazing how many of the younger generation, they don't wear watches, they just check their phone all the time. Now Stan said the other thing we do is we look at the sun. Although the sun's always a little tricky for me, because if this were in the middle of the summer and the sun looked like this, this could be later in the day when you look at the sky, because it looks, you know, it stays a lot brighter than this and such. But we all know what that's like. We measure time by the sun. We measure it by our watch. Now this summer, the Garnicks went out to South Dakota. And in South Dakota, they went underground at Wind Cave. I went to Wind Cave a long time ago. I was in fifth grade. I'd like to go back, but have never made it back there. And you went down in the bottom of there, and when they got down the bottom, they shut all the lights off, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's absolutely pitch black, which is really weird to be someplace where there's no light, okay? Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but they've actually taken people with experiences as an experiment, and they put them underground in a cave where there's no light like that. Not natural light, not sunlight. They only have lights like this. And they take away clocks and things, and they have them live, and they find out, the fancy word that we use for it is your circadian rhythm, that you wake up at a certain time and you go to bed at a certain time. My wife and I tend to wake up around 6 o'clock to 6:30, and we kind of wake up that way, and so on and so forth. And you kind of develop a rhythm. What? Oh, yeah, my wife says 3, 2, 1. Yeah, yeah. Some of you know what that's like. You wake up at other odd times. But you have a rhythm that you have. And they found out when they put those people down there and they're not around the sun, they're out of the sunlight like this, and they are not exposed to natural light, their rhythm gets all messed up. And they totally lose track of what time of day it is. They have no idea. Because your body kind of has a rhythm, but your rhythm is somewhat set by, as Stan was saying, by where the sun is and your exposure to light. Now, the reason I tell you all that is because when we move out into eternity, one of the things that is true about eternity is we would, for lack of a better way of explaining it, eternity is outside of
time.
There's not the measure of time in eternity the way we keep time. You won't have to carry a watch. You won't have to say, oh, God said all of us show up this afternoon at 3 o'clock for the hymn sing. You know, it's not going to be like that in eternity. And that's kind of a weird thing for us to think about in eternity, that we're not going to keep time. One of the things that's not going to be around is the sun. There'll be no sun out there. There'll be no moon. There'll be a universe, but it's going to be different than our universe. And you and I are not going to be depending on the light of the sun to measure the passage of time. In fact, in the book of Genesis, and Ben had gone over this with us last winter, and then Jim kind of had gone over a little bit more of this with us since that time when we were talking about creation downstairs in the adult class, that the measurement of time, that's part of the reason that God oriented the stars and the moon and the sun to the planet as they are for the keeping of times and seasons. So one of the things that, you know, my wife always points this out, I don't know if the rest of you, if we were in the middle of the summer, the light would have a very different quality. You ever notice that? That right now we kind of have a fall quality of light. But in the middle of the summer, the light has an intensity that is different than this. And we kind of can measure that by where the sun is positioned, not just this way, but where it is this way on our horizon. We live in a northern hemisphere, so we really notice that change and that difference. So we're going to be talking a little bit about, I may take a couple of weeks on this. I don't think we're going to go through it all today, but we'll talk a little bit about eternity and some things I think that are important for us to get in understanding eternity. So we've been looking at these dispensations for several months now. We just finished here looking at the fullness of times and the descent, the second coming here, and the descent of the New Jerusalem. And now we're going to move out here into this period of time that we call eternity. And one of the things that happens the stage setting for what happens in eternity is that God is going to make all things new, and we're going to see that. He's going to create a whole new heavens and a new earth. But I want us to take our Bibles, and I want us to look at just a couple of statements about eternity itself. So let's go first of all to Isaiah chapter 57. The difficult thing, I'll just be real honest, when you go to the Old Testament, is we have an expression in the Hebrew. Let's all learn a Hebrew expression. Olam. Everybody else?
Olam.
Olam. It's a Hebrew word. And you know what olam means? A really long time. Sometimes it means the life of a man. Looks at the life of a man as olam. A long-lived man is an olam life. And sometimes olam refers to what we call as eternity. It has to be interpreted in context. It does not have a defined meaning. It's just kind of for a very long period of time. And it may be eternally long, or it may be a man's lifetime. So it's a little bit tricky sometimes when people try to understand this. But in Isaiah 57, Isaiah chapter 57 and verse 15, we read, "For thus says the high and exalted one." Who do you think that is? Who's the high and exalted one? God. Okay? I was hoping maybe I could get one of the kids to answer that. But the high and exalted. God's the one that's high and he's exalted. That means he's over everything. And he, now the New American Standard says, lives forever. But this expression that lives forever literally is an expression that he inhabits or dwells in olam, dwells in eternity. Doesn't mean he dwells forever, but he inhabits this place that we would call eternity. When God created the universe, did God create the universe because he needed the universe? No. I mean, does God need anything other than himself? No, he doesn't. He doesn't need us. There are people, I've heard people say this, God created man because God wanted fellowship. How many of you like to be alone a lot? See, most people don't like to be alone a lot. We're not designed to be people that spend our time alone. We were designed to be people that function together with other people, to work together. That's God's design for us. Okay? But does God need that? Does God need a bunch of us down here to run around going, "Oh, finally, I got some people to talk to"? We have a whole other truth in the scriptures. The fancy word we use for it is the word Trinity. Trinity means that God is three persons. What are those three persons, Aaron? God. God the Son, God the Father, God the Holy Spirit. Exactly. That's the Trinity. Those three persons who are all God, did they need us to have fellowship? No. They had perfect fellowship among themselves. God has other purposes, that he created us for other reasons, not just because God, or not because, oh, I need fellowship. I need someone to talk to. I need someone to interact with. That's not why he created us. It is something that was part of, Scripture says, part of his good pleasure. It is something that pleased him, but he didn't need it. Okay? And so he's the one that inhabits eternity. This is where God dwells. He dwells outside of time. He didn't need the universe. Here's a question for you. Was there heaven before God created the universe? No, because that's actually one of the things that God tells us in Genesis 1 that he created. He created the heavens, plural. Not one heaven, the plural heavens. Even the heaven. Did God need a throne room with a throne to sit on? No. What does he need that for? He's a spirit being. In fact, he's a spirit being that's so big that the universe can't contain him. Solomon says that. One heaven can't contain him, much less all the heavens cannot contain him. He's so big. So what is creating a heaven with a throne room that we know that angels go to and people eventually go to? What does God need that for? He doesn't need that. That's for our benefit and the benefit of angels or spirit beings. They're the ones that needed a place. And so when we're talking about eternity, we're talking about the fact that God dwells outside the realm of the physical universe. He doesn't need the physical universe. He doesn't need time. He doesn't have a watch on his hand going, oh, that's right, I was going to. He doesn't need those things. He's the one that set time. He's the one that put those things in motion. And those are for our benefit and the benefit of creation. So it says, he inhabits eternity. His name is holy. Which, we don't need to get into a whole other Bible study, but the significance of his name is holy, and there's nobody else like that. That's really the idea of holy, is he's distinct and set apart. There's nobody else like God in that way. Everybody else relates to time. God does not relate to time in any way that we understand. Okay? Let's turn over to Psalm 90. Psalm 90. Psalm 90. And we could have sung this song this morning. I was actually looking for the guitar chords on this, and I would have had to download them off of the site where we have this song. The kids have sung this, and I think we've sung this with the background music and such here at church. But it says, we have that song that sings, "Who made God? Who made God? Nobody made God." And we sing this. Verse 1 says, "Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations before the mountains were born, or you ever gave birth to the earth and the world. From everlasting," or from Olam, "even unto Olam, you are God." In other words, if we went all the way back to the very long time in the past, even to the very long time way out in the present, in all of that, you've always been God. It's always the way you are. Eternity in the past, you were God. Eternity in the future, you're God. God didn't create this because he needed this. This has a purpose in what God does, but he didn't need it. He is eternally God. So this is this idea of God, everlasting, everlasting, eternity to eternity. Again, it's kind of how you have to choose to interpret it, because we have this expression Olam, which is just a term for an indeterminate long period of time. And it is used both ways, just trying to be clear on that. So God dwells in eternity. You and I don't dwell in eternity yet. We're looking forward to a time in which we're going to be in eternity. Can you imagine moving into a time in which you're no longer going to be keeping time by the sun, by your watch, by your phone, or what are other ways that we keep time? Isabella turned a year. And when you look at pictures from that little, I still remember last year going over, we went over to Garnick's there, and it was just Jeremy and the boys for Bible study that night. And I remember showing them the picture of my brand new granddaughter, and I still remember Clayton's words. She looks angry. Because, you know, brand new baby, scrunched up face like this, you know. She's not like that now. Now she's this little kid that most of the time she's just happy, smiling all the time, and jabbering away at you like that. Time's passed, and she's still not this little teeny 6-pound, 15-ounce baby anymore. Now she's, I don't know how big she is. All I know is I carried her a while the other day on a path and thought, man, this kid's getting heavy. You know, but time passes. Some of you in here, it's not just that you've gotten taller and older, but as you get older, you also can measure passage of time by the fact, yeah, that's right, my hip hurts, and it doesn't seem to ever get better. It just kind of continues to hurt all the time now. Oh, that's again reminding me I'm getting older. So there's ways that we measure time. When you've got an eternity, I don't think you're going to go from dark hair to, I don't know what color hair we're going to have in eternity, but you're not going to go from dark hair to silver hair or something like that out there in eternity. You're not going to get older. You're not going to develop aches and pains. Man, I've been under an eternity for 10,000 years, just like it said in Amazing Grace. And boy, my hips are really hurting now. You know, it's not going to be that way. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. There, in other words, there's ways that we mark the passing of time. There's ways that we mark the passing of time that we're not going to have to do those things. I'm really glad for that. We're going to see that in just a little bit here as we look at some other scriptures. So let's go over to the book of Revelation. Let's go to Revelation chapter 21. At the end of chapter 20, before the great white throne, in fact, I'm going to have us, I don't have that verse up here, but I want us to look at this. Look back in chapter 20 and verse 11 before we go into chapter 21. It says, "And I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose presence the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was no place that was found for them." Now, there are a lot of people, I'm just going to say this, there are a lot of Christians, people even that I respect, that think that God is going to fix all of this up, and that's what we're going to go into eternity on. But if this passage, as well as other passages, mean anything, everything that I see now, this whole earth and the whole universe that I see, it's all gone. God is not just fixing it up. It's not like taking a ball of Play-Doh and going, oh, I made this horse. Now I'm going to smash it up and I'm going to make an elephant out of it or a ball. He actually completely gets rid of it. It all passes away. And now we turn to chapter 21 and we read with us. I'm going to jump down to verse 5. Let's just start, let's go with verse 1 and read down to verse 5. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, because the first heaven and the first earth," what? "Passed away, and there's no longer any sea." Now, one of the significance of this idea in here, when he says that it is passed away, is significant here, is that that word either means it's gone or it moved to another place. Now, that means that if it moved to another place and it still exists, but it's moved to another place, that means what we know kind of still is going on. But it seems that the simpler, easier way to interpret this is, when it says it passed away, it's just gone. That's the simple, more obvious way of handling what he says here. It is passed away, it's no there, and there's no longer any sea. My poor wife, I'm glad she'd be glorified, because she's okay with this, but you know one of her favorite places to go? It's to the ocean. It doesn't even have to be warm. It doesn't even have to be Hawaii or Southern California or someplace warm. She can enjoy the cold Washington coast, and she can enjoy standing on the beach, watching the waves roll in and lap against the beach. She can enjoy that. Not in eternity, because when God creates the new earth out there, there's no sea on that earth. It shows you right there, there's going to be something significantly different about planet Earth out there. Is it going to be a, let's just do some mind benders. I'm not suggesting that this is what God's saying. But when he creates, he also says there back in verse 1, that I saw a new heaven and a new earth. He uses the adjective kainos, which means a new kind of heaven and a new kind of earth. It's not naos. Naos would mean a fresh earth. Like you've revitalized what was here and made it fresh. But that's not the adjective he uses. He uses the adjective kainos, which means it's new in kind. So the earth is going to be different. Is it going to be bigger? I don't know. Is it going to be square? Well, you don't have square planets. Why not? Why couldn't God make a square? I'm not saying he is. I'm just saying it's different. And I don't know how it's going to be different. He gives us one way it's different. It doesn't have a sea. That's one way it's different. So I don't know how it's going to be new and different, but he tells us it is. And I think that's an important thing for us to understand. Verse 2, I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out from heaven from God, made ready like a bride. Doesn't say it is the bride. It's like a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle or tent of God is among men. He shall dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be among them. Verse 4, and he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death, neither shall there any more be mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. He who sits on the throne says, behold, I make all things new. And he says, write these words, they are faithful and they are true. He says, I'm going to make all things new. They are going to be different. We're going to make everything different. It's going to be so different. It's kind of a joke. This used to be Bill Kemp and Dan Dahlke's joke that they used to joke back and forth about eternity, about going off, and I couldn't tell you what it is, but some star off distant that they were going to go off there and fish out in eternity out there. And you know what? We've got another guy that jokes about that. Gordon does that. Gordon makes that same joke. Going to go fishing out there on that star. But the thing is, that is taking the things of this world. And this is what a lot of people do. You ever seen the flyers that the Jehovah's Witnesses pass out? Jehovah's Witnesses are not Christians, remember? They're not believers. They have a Jesus Christ who is not God. And he didn't rise again from the dead. He stopped. He went from being a dead man to being spirit. So he didn't rise bodily. And you're saved by works in that environment. All that to say, they're not believers. They're not Christians. They're not going to heaven. Not if they believe that. Those Jehovah's Witnesses have flyers out there, and they have mom and dad and a little boy and a little girl all walking through a field, beautiful flowers and trees, and they're walking. I've seen this. I've seen this flyer many times, walking through a field. And it's like, isn't this what you would like? Because that's what we do, right? You go out and you pick, what is like the best day I've ever had here on earth? I'm not going to ask you to try and do that, because some of you, the rest of the message, you'd be sitting there going, what was my best day? Why don't you do that? But that's what they do. What's like the best day I've ever had on earth? And then they transport that out of eternity, and they say, eternity is going to be like that. Oh, one of my best days. And I don't know if this was true of Bill and Dan or of Gordon, but apparently fishing was something they thought was really great. And so they were thinking, hey, wouldn't it be great someday to go fishing? Now, they were joking about that. They weren't serious. I hope you all understand that. None of them were ever saying, yeah, we're really going to go fishing in eternity. But that joke is just kind of a communication that that's the way a lot of people view eternity, right? We think eternity is going to be like the best day we've ever had. Dan Argo will not be able to get hurt in any way, so he's not going to climb just a little bit. He's going to be able to climb 20,000 feet precipices, cliffs, things like that. See? Isn't that what we do? We take like things we really enjoy doing down here, and we think, I'm going to do that out there in eternity. You guys know me. I'm a doofus. I like comic books. I always thought, oh, it'll be cool out in eternity. I think we really will fly, but I don't think at that time I'm going to go, hey, I'm like Superman. I don't think I'm going to care one whip about that. But we will. We're not going to be hampered in bodies that have to go, oh, I can't get out there where God is because, well, there's no road out there. I think God's going to be able to make us go. And we'll be able to do those things. What? Yes, because we'll be with God. Exactly. And so he makes all things new. And it's going to be new and in a completely different way. I just think this is one of the things that boggles my mind. When we try to think about what heaven's going to be like, I don't know how many of you realize that the Bible actually tells us about that much about heaven. We always think there's all kinds of things about heaven. There's things about the New Jerusalem. There's some things about the New Earth. But there's not really a whole lot that tells us specifically what heaven's going to be like. I think some of it is because it's beyond our ability to really get a good picture in our mind about what heaven really will be like, other than the fact that we will be in the presence of God. So, with that then, I want us to go back. We talked about this in Isaiah chapter 65. Because here in Revelation 21, he says, I make a new heaven, and it's singular. But we have other passages in Isaiah 57. I'm just going to look at this one. You can turn there with me. We're going to go to 2 Peter here in just a minute. But Isaiah chapter 57, 65, pardon me. I'm thinking 57 because we were, Jim had us in 57 this morning, and we were there last week, I believe. But Isaiah 65 and verse 17, for behold, I create new heavens, again, plural, and a new earth. Earth is singular, but heavens, again, are plural. Okay, so he's going to create a new heaven. Does that mean he's going to create new planets? And new? I don't know. I don't exactly know what it means when he says he creates new heavens, other than the fact that he says he does. I think he's probably implying it's going to be something that I can maybe kind of think about broadly in terms of what we know, but I'm not really supposed to use this primarily as a template, meaning it has to be identical to this. Because as we already saw in Revelation, it's going to be completely new, a new kind of thing. Take your Bibles and turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, and I want us to go back, and I want us to consider some of the other things that he says here leading up in this context. We're going to probably touch on this at another time, but not here this morning specifically. If we go back to verse 10, it says, but the day of the Lord, now the day of the Lord is Daniel's 70th week and the following kingdom, that stretch of the kingdom that goes for 1,000 years. Now that kingdom, remember, doesn't end at 1,000 years. The 1,000 years are the time that those dead individuals rise and reign with Christ, and in which the kingdom that God had promised to Israel is fulfilled. Jim's going to be going over that with some of us in the adult class downstairs and talking about some of those things. But that's the day of the Lord. It's the day of the Lord in which he judges, which the Lord is judge. And he's judged during Daniel's 70th week, and he's judged during the 1,000 years. So it says, but the day of the Lord comes like a thief, in which, during that time, the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with an intense heat, and the earth and its works will all be burned up. Now, it doesn't say that that happens during Daniel's 70th week. It doesn't say that that happens at the beginning of the millennial kingdom or in the middle. That happens according to Revelation chapter 20. We just looked at that at the beginning, Revelation 20:11. That happens towards the end of the day of the Lord, just before Christ judges all people at the great white throne. All unsaved people, by the way, not believers. Does everybody get that? Let's just make sure you understand that. It's at the end of the day of the Lord, before the great white throne, that all of this universe is destroyed. The heavens and the earth pass away. And so he says, all of those things, they melt, they're destroyed at the intense heat. Verse 11, since all these things are destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? If you want an application of the passage, you don't have to sit and invent one. Peter tells us right there, this is the application. There is an application for you in understanding that everything you look at out there is going to be burned up. The application is, it ought to make you live differently. Because Peter's writing to people just like you and I. We have a tendency to sink our roots pretty deep in this world, in the things of this world, in all the responsibilities of this world. And we tend to be people that we have a tough time looking beyond this world to something better. And we can invest our lives so much in this that we fail to see there's something so much greater and better beyond this. And so he says, if you know all this is going to be destroyed, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Illustrate this. Just a little over a week ago, there was a hurricane that pushed up, what do they call that part of Florida and Alabama in there where that came in? The panhandle. Thank you. And it came in there. And if you see some of the videos, my wife pulled this up a couple times and was looking at some of this and showed me some of the video they have of the destruction, that there are whole communities where there's nothing left standing. It's all just flattened. Now, let's just take, for instance, that God had come down and said, my plans is that on this date in October, this hurricane's going to come on and it's just going to blow right through there. And you had just got your load of lumber in there and you were just going to get ready to start framing up your brand new house. Woo! And then all of a sudden God says, well, I'm going to have a hurricane come through. Would you go ahead with your plans and start building that house if you knew that God was going to blow that down in a week and is going to send that lumber from your house all over the neighborhood? No, you wouldn't. So the application of this is don't build houses. No, that's not the application. That was an illustration. The point is if you remember, if you just keep in mind that all of this is going to disappear, it always causes you to live with regard to whatever you have in life, your job, your family, your house, the things around you, your garden. Leaves you always that you live with a little bit, just kind of a light touch. You don't go, it's eternal. We're not Mormons. My daughter and I were just having this conversation the other day when we were going out to get coffee that we were talking about. In eternity, guess what? I won't be coming up going, hey, you're my daughter. You were my daughter because you're still my daughter. In eternity, she won't be my daughter. I won't be her dad. Not in eternity. Mormons teach that. They teach the family is eternal. That's a lie. There is an eternal family. God's the Father and we're all His kids. That's the eternal family. But I'm going to have a completely different relationship. And so if I remember all of this changes, application, I'm going to live a little bit lighter with less got to hold on to it type of mentality. That's a challenge. It's a real slap in the face to all of us. I'm as guilty of it as the next person. Don't look at me and go, oh, you think you're better than... No, I struggle with this as much as the next person. And we ought to be those people that live in holy conduct and godliness. That is, our lives really ought to be set apart to God, not set apart to all of this. And godliness, we ought to be honoring God, but we have a tendency to kind of wrap ourselves up in all of this. Looking for and hastening. Hastening doesn't mean to speed it along. It means to be eager for, to be eagerly anticipating the coming of the day of God. Now, the day of God is beyond the day of the Lord. It's a time in which not just the Lord is judged, but in which God, we'll talk about that more next week, but in which we're going to see God act as God in a way we've never been able to witness before. The day of God, on account of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, the elements, notice this, the very elements. What are the elements? It's the little things that make up the world. It's the atoms. It's the subatomic particles. I don't know how technical you want to get, but the very elements, they all melt with an intense heat. It's not just God reforms and burns off the planet Earth, like farmers around here might burn off some ground so that they can break it and plant a crop on it. He actually totally breaks down and dissolves the very elements that make this universe up. Think about that. And then he says with verse 13, but according to His promises, we are looking for, we are eagerly expecting, new heavens, plural again, and a new earth in which, here's one of the best things about this, in which righteousness will settle down and be at home. Are you looking forward to that? Are you looking forward to a universe in which you're actually going to get to see righteousness settle down and be at home? I can guarantee you we could probably get a fight started right here among this group of people simply by talking about politics in this world. Talking about how righteous this person is versus this person. We've got, boy, I'm telling you, we don't have regular television at our house, but when we were over there and we, Peg and I'd go down to the hotel and we'd be eating breakfast and the local television is playing. You're not seeing ads for cars right now and trucks and things like that. You're seeing ads for this initiative and for this political person to vote for or vote against and so on and so forth. This is like, oh, I'm so glad I'm not being inundated with all this garbage where everybody's vilifying everybody else because I don't care who they are in government. We don't see righteous government in this world. We see little maybe samples of some righteousness now and then. But we don't see righteousness at home. You're never going to see righteousness at home. I don't care who you elect to office. Righteousness is never going to settle down and be at home, is it? Not in this world. You're just going to get little glimpses of some righteousness here and there, maybe. We're looking forward to a time and a place in the future in which righteousness is going to dwell. It's going to settle down and be at home. Is that something to look forward to? then instead of going, oh, how, who should I elect for? Let's research these candidates because I want to vote for the most righteous candidate I can find. And then you elect that candidate and you find out that that candidate's got some unrighteous past that has all been hidden. Because I guarantee you that's probably going to be true of most of the candidates that are running, no matter whether they're your candidate or another person's candidate. Because they're like you, right? They're people that have a tendency to have some unrighteous issues. And so we're looking forward to something better than that. And you and I as believers ought to be people like that. We ought to be people that are looking forward to a whole new universe with things way better than anything that we can understand or imagine in the present time. Now, I want to go from here, if I've got this right. I want to go back over to Revelation chapter 21. Where he tells us in here, as we've already read, he says, I'm making all things new. And write these down. This is trustworthy and true. In other words, you can count on the fact. Sometimes, if we were to go back over to 2 Peter 3, where we just left, how does the first part of 2 Peter 3, chapter 3, start? Peter's talking about there's mockers out there. There's mocking mockers who mock. Oh, that's actually Jude that says that, which I always think is funny. Mocking mockers who mock. But Peter says there are mockers who do mock, he says. And what do they mock? Oh, he ain't coming back. Because look at everything is, it's been like this since the fathers lived. So this is what you see is what you get. It's just more of the same. And we live around that kind of a mentality all the time. But no, God says, no, this is trustworthy and true. I'm going to make all things new. From our time, from our perspective, okay, 1,000 years, God says, from his perspective is like a day. Or, as he said to the psalmist, like a watch in the night, about 3 hours. So how long has it been since Jesus Christ ascended and sat down at the Father's right hand? 6 hours to 48 hours, one way or another. Not a long time has passed since he left and coming back. For us, it seems like, well, good grief, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. Generations of Christians have come and gone, and he hasn't come back yet. Maybe they're right. Maybe the mockers are right. Maybe it is going to always go on. No, he says, he's trustworthy and true. God is trustworthy. He is going to make all things new. What he said he's going to do. Now, what are some of the things that he says he's going to do in this context? Look back up. Verse 2 and 3. He talks to us about this holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down. It comes down like a bride, prepared like a bride. What does that mean? It means it's adorned and readied. It's not kind of half done. It's not a little, we didn't get that place over there cleaned up and swept. I can guarantee you, most weddings that you're going to go to, a bride shows up, they've done everything in their power, the people that are working with her, to make sure that every smudge and every bit of dirt and anything that might be on her dress here, there, everything's clean. And that's the idea. It's all clean. It's all beautified. It's all ready. I'm not going to walk down there to the altar, put it in a modern marriage setting. She shows up and the husband's going, you got something right there. You got something. I'm not going to do that. What's with your hair? You know, it's kind of like, well, okay, so if you had one outside, what are you going to do? Blow away. I think they use, about 3 cans of hairspray in that type of situation, right? But everything's in place. And that's what he's saying about the New Jerusalem. It comes down and it's beautiful. Everything is there. Now, the New Jerusalem is not the entirety. This is one thing. In fact, what does he say here in verse 2? We talked about this a few weeks back. We're talking about the kingdom. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem. What does it say? Coming down out of heaven from God. That means that the New Jerusalem is not heaven. There are people that read the New Jerusalem, they go, well, this is heaven. Heaven's got streets of gold. What they do is they come over and read this passage. They can't even read, well, let's put it in our situation, they can't even read plain English translation. Even plain English translation says it comes down out of heaven. It doesn't say it is heaven. So people go, oh, heaven's got street of gold. And they always say streets of gold. It doesn't say it has streets. It says it has a street. And it says there's a river of life in that city. And they all make that heaven, but it's not heaven. It's just coming down out of heaven from God. He's created new heavens and new earth, and out of that new heaven, the new Jerusalem descends. And it comes down. And it's going to be, as he says there, the tent of God. Our Bibles translate it, my New American Standard translates it, the tabernacle of God. Tabernacle is just an old English word for tent, and that's what the word is. It's a skene, it's a tent. It's not an oikos, it's not a house. It's a tent, because it's not a permanent dwelling of God. Because it's not where God dwells all the time. Because God is not confined to heaven, to the New Jerusalem, or to put his feet on the earth, as he pictures it in the Old Testament. Because, as we said, God dwells in eternity. Now, so, we've got the New Jerusalem. I tried to make it a little bit more to scale. There it is. It's gold. It is as high as it is wide, and as it is long on the earth. And I have no idea if that's what it's going to look like. That is one person's idea. It may be completely different. Maybe it'll be a pyramid. J. Vernon McGee thinks it's going to be a sphere because a sphere is as high as it is wide. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think it'll be a sphere because it does have a foundation with a wall. And I don't know exactly how you put a foundation and a wall on a sphere. But if that's what it is, God knows how to do it. I'm just telling you and suggesting this might be one example of what that New Jerusalem will look like. And it probably won't look like that, he said. Yeah, except we wouldn't have earth. You're saying the earth won't look like that. Yeah, the earth won't look like that probably at that time. That's a picture, because we have no idea what the earth is. And that earth's got a sea, and there's no sea in there. On earth. I should have just found a ball, huh?
That comes down during the end of the tribulation.
Yes, it does descend. Yes. But it also comes down here at the beginning of eternity again, which means apparently it is withdrawn during this time. And this is, by the way, the New Jerusalem, that's what Jesus is referring to when he says that he's going to prepare a place for us. This is where he's going. He's getting a place ready because this is where we're going to temporarily be with the Lord. Temporarily meaning that's not permanently where we'll be with him. We'll be with him in another place on a more permanent level, but this is the temporary place. Now, let's look at this next statement. And it says verse 4-5 up here, but it should be verse 4. And it says, "And he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be death. There shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain, because the first things have passed away." Every individual in here knows pain and loss to some degree. I can guarantee probably most of the kids probably do not know pain and loss to the same degree that the adults do. They've experienced those things. It just isn't dramatic. But you live long enough, guess what? You experience pain and loss. Sometimes the pain's physical. You're like Stan. Your back hurts really bad. Doctors have to try to fix that up. And they do the best they can. We're thankful that the doctor did a good job. But Stan will still tell you he's not like he was 60 years ago. Things change, right? But there's also other kind of pain. I have very little physical pain. My wife deals with the daily. I have very little physical pain in my body at this point in my life. That could all change today for all I know. But I have very little. But I've gone through other things that are painful. I've gone through other things that are loss. I've lost people that are very dear to me. And it's hard. It hurts. Sometimes it still hurts even when you go through some of the, even when a time has passed. And some of you know that way better than I do. So if you just stop and think about that, you think about the different causes that cause us to cry, cause those. One of them he mentions there is death. Think about how painful death is. Do we as believers all know that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord? Do we know that? Do we know that the Bible says that? And therefore, when we have a loved one go, we're going, "Woo, they're with God. I'm good. Party time." Is that the way we are? No, not really. Because it hurts. Because we miss them. We miss their companionship, their friendship, their voice, their smell. We miss things about them. And it causes us pain. And the thing is, all of us know that to some degree. Some of us more than others. He says, "There'll be no death. No longer will there be any mourning or crying. There's a lot of things that cause us to mourn and cry other than just death. You go through something, a lot of you have gone through things with loved ones while they're going through a long-term chronic illness. And there's pain and there's mourning and there may be even crying over a loved one that's facing a long-term chronic illness. And they're not even dying from it. It's just, what's the expression we use today? This is our new normal. It may not be the normal I like, but this is the way it is. And you go through that and there is mourning and crying. Not out there. All this is gone.
Most of all that's related to the sin nature. So is that part of it, that the sin nature is gone?
I don't know that I would say any of it is necessarily related to the sin nature. It can be related. Death is, but I don't think that that's...
A lot of our pain is from death, and sickness is from the sin nature.
I understand that, but I don't think that he doesn't seem to be emphasizing that. He doesn't seem to bring that up. If it seemed that he was trying to emphasize here that the sin nature is gone, which I agree that it is, I think it would be clearer in this context. And he just seems to be talking about the fact that out there in this new creation, these things that we associate with life that are a problem, they're gone. This is one of the reasons that we need to understand these things. Our life is not just about how do I get from today to tomorrow. One of the ways you get from today to tomorrow is learning to look beyond tomorrow to say, you know, the Lord could come back for me in the rapture tomorrow, all of us, or next week. But even looking beyond that, what did Peter say? We don't even just look for the rapture. He says we look for the day of God. The day of God is when all things will be made new, when the creation will be new. He says, we look beyond that. We look out there to that time. And most of us as Christians, we have a tough time looking beyond this tomorrow, this week. And when we're overwhelmed, let me just look at one passage here that just kind of puts this in perspective. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is off the outline, but we're kind of at a place where we're going to stop here. But 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and you have to give me just a moment here to locate. There it is. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He says in verse 29, Peggy and I have had this discussion about what he means here. He says, but this I say, brethren, the time is shortened, or the time is short. Now, what does he mean when the time is shortened? There's different interpretations. Some of it is saying that the Corinthians are going through a problem, a short-term problem here, and it'll end eventually. Well, you know, that's true of anything that we go through in life. It's short. But I think his real point is, you know, the Lord could come back at any moment. Now, I might be reading something into the passage that isn't directly there, but I do think this is probably part of his idea. The time is shortened so that from now on, those who have wives should be as though they have none. We don't like that. But that's telling us, you just remember, marriage is not the be-all, end-all. There's more to life than just marriage. He's not saying, husbands, blow off your wives. He's just saying, don't say that my whole life consists of this. Because then he goes on, those who weep as though they did not weep. I think I've told you this story before. Some of you have heard it, some of you haven't. My wife lost an aunt years ago. We weren't married yet. We were engaged, but not married. I went to her dorm room. I was just learning some real good biblical truth. And this was one of the things I'd recently learned, but I was dumber than a rock. Because I walk into her dorm room. She's crying. I said, what's the matter? And she says, my Aunt Melba died. She's crying. I said, well, those who weep should not weep. So you should stop crying. You know, she still married me. I can't believe that woman still married me when I told her to quit crying. That's not what he's talking about. He's just saying sometimes we can be so overwhelmed by grief that we can't see beyond it. That we don't realize the time's short. You should not let weeping or grief define your life. He's not telling you can't cry. Because remember elsewhere, what does he tell Christians to do? Weep with those who weep. How do you balance those two? By just putting in perspective that here he's simply saying, don't let this be the thing that defines you. and all of us know Christians that are defined by something of grief that happened to them years ago, and they've never moved beyond it. Or the other part of it, the next thing he says, or those who rejoice, as though they did not rejoice. The Bible says rejoice, and again I say rejoice. Yeah, but in the context, we can be so moved by things that we're just, we're defined by some little thing that happened, and that again is the same thing, that we're always like that. And I think probably in the context, he's talking about joy related to something that maybe happens in this world. And I think this is really what he's getting at. It has to do with loving the world too much. It's kind of the same issue that Peter was dealing with. Hey, all this is going to be burned up. How should it affect your conduct? You should be holy and godly in your daily conduct. And he goes on there. And those that buy, I always joke about this, those who buy as though they did not possess it. So when you go to the store and you buy all your items, make sure you pay for them, but then leave them on the counter and go home. Boy, Ben and Josh would be doing good business if every time you went down to the store, you just left all your groceries behind and you never took them out of the store. They'd restock all that stuff eventually. That's not what he's talking about. He's just saying you don't possess it. You buy things, but you don't go, oh, my life is complete because I finally got. You know how many years I looked for this Bible? And I'm not joking, this Bible. I saw this when I was in seminary and I did not have enough money to buy this. I had other things I needed, and so I left this on the shelf in the bookstore. But I wanted it. It's a New American Standard with an interlinear that I had in it. Boy, I'm telling you, when I walked into a bookstore in Michigan with my brother-in-law and saw this on the shelf, I was like, yes, I've been looking for this book for 20 years. Seriously, it was about 20 years by the time I actually found it again. But you know what? My life is not defined by what I possess. We have a tough time with that. I finally got the car I've always wanted. I got the house I've always wanted. I've got the, I don't know, fill in the blank. It's different for every one of us. All of this, just as we're closing this off, we're just reminding ourselves, there are things that are part of this life, crying and pain and death. Those things can define us. They shouldn't define us as believers, but they do. But out there in eternity, they'll all be gone. We won't be defined in any way by those things. Paul's encouraged us in 1 Corinthians 7 not to let those things define us. To be able to look beyond those. To remember, you know, the time's short. And if the time is short, I don't want to be defined by these things that are temporary. I don't want these to be the things that I'm, this is the be-all, end-all. This is the thing. I got to have this. As we look forward to eternity, not just the rapture. I am looking forward to the rapture. You should be looking forward to the rapture. You should be desiring that that would happen now. I don't care what you have planned for today or this week. You can say, I'll give it all up. I wouldn't have cared if I saw my granddaughter turn one at her birthday party. The rapture is better by far. Immensely better. But it's hard for us to do that because we get so wrapped up in this world and its life. But you know what's even better than the rapture? Moving out into eternity. Because even after the rapture, you and I are going to have to witness some stuff that's going to be pretty ugly. We're going to witness Daniel's 70th week. We won't be party to it. We will be in heaven with him. But we're still going to witness the ugliness that goes on. We're going to have to witness Christ coming back at the second coming and slaying an army of over 200 million men. Now, we will be glorified. I think we'll have a different perspective on it than we would at the present time. But we're still going to be exposed to those things. Even during the millennial kingdom, those 1,000 years, we've been looking at things go on in the millennial kingdom. There are things that are going to happen at times that are going to be unrighteous, that Christ will deal with like that, swiftly, not a delay. We will be witness to that. Looking out in the future, as he makes all things new, we're going to see a completely different world, a different environment, a whole new kind of universe. And that's something that Peter, Paul, even Isaiah, all encourage people to anticipate something new, something different. And it should change and affect the way we think and the way we live our lives right now. We'll come back. We'll pick up. We've got some other things. Who gets these things in the future? I think most of us could answer those questions, but we're going to answer those or let the Bible answer those next week. Father, we're thankful for the time that you've given us together. We're thankful for the fact that your word tells us that you have this great absolutely granted. It's even hard for us to find adjectives to describe something that is so new, so different than what we're used to. This new universe, this whole new way of existence in your presence and you with us. You've given these things to us now to help temper our attitude towards these things in the world that are temporary. And we ask as believers that we would have a tempered attitude. We would be very measured and cautious with how involved and wrapped up we just get ourselves in life. There are things, we have to attend to those things, Lord, but you don't want us to make those things that which defines us. Let us be defined by eternal things, things that are bigger and grander than just the small things of this world and this life. We're thankful for this time together. We're thankful again for your word, all these things that you tell us about yourself and what you will do, and even the things that we're going to get to witness out there. We thank you for this then. Amen.